I woke up, you know, typically heroin junkie-esque, you know, in the late afternoon today. And so, like, I'm thinking I'm going to last till the sun comes up, at least, you know, today. You know, Friday, I'll be up until, you know, the late a.m., probably even into the afternoon a little bit on Friday. But then Saturday is like a fucking stacked, fucking shitty, fucking whatever thing. And it'll start early. My mom and a friend are coming down from Santa Rosa. And the idea is to have, like, dinner and tiki drinks and cupcakes and all that kind of stuff. And then I said, like, oh, you'll be here on our Relodeo day. I should take you down there and, like, let you see it, you know. Just to show it off, not to be, like, join us for hours at a time, because they wouldn't have the capacity, really, for... They just want to look at it from, you know, like it's like a diorama or something. It's like, oh, look at the saber-toothed tiger, you know, kind of thing. And so I figure what'll happen there is we'll arrive to Relodeo's studio kind of on the early side, you know, like 9. Like in the old days, 9 was like the time to arrive. Now it's 10. But I figure, like, we'll arrive on the early side. I'll turn everything on, I'll turn the candles on, I'll turn some music on and say, like, well, this is what it looks like when it's just me here, whatever, right? Me and Sarah. And then Hal is going to show up with what I'm tentatively calling the Art Lunch Bunch. Like his art comic drawing pal group friends thing. They apparently are coming tomorrow as well. Doug is not coming on tomorrow, I mean Relodeo. Doug will not be at Relodeo on Saturday. But the idea, there was some idea that it's just like, oh, well, Hal's two friends and Michael Pepe can just take my spot, right? And it's like, how is that even possible? Which it kind of isn't. So I kind of furiously... No, I wasn't masturbating, but I was furiously texting Michael Pepe saying, are you planning on coming on Saturday? Because if you do, I think it's going to be a problem. And then explanation, exposition, rattle, rattle, rattle. And saying, like, if you come, like, really late. Of course, by that time, I'll probably be a zombie. And, like, Michael Pepe's presence would actually kind of give the show a second wind, maybe, at that point. Which could be cool, but I say, like, maybe you want to back off this week. And I never, like, declined Michael Pepe's, like, inclination to come. Even though it's, like, I don't... Like, I'm the guy facilitating his ride, yet I'm the last guy to know that he's coming. Kind of a thing. who cares? It's just K-Rob. He's cool. Yeah, just give him some nice cereal. Don't shut the fuck up. It's too many people. Here's the thing. The room is built for four. The room is built for four. And it can handle a non-broadcasting guest or a jerry-rigged guest... Right? Like, if you jerry-rig a guest, it's like, what you're doing is that you're, like, you're going, like, all right, let me get this over here, look at that over here, you know, get this, go, okay, we're going to move this over here, and then we're good, let me just get this to work, and then we'll, okay, do you have any headphones? Oh, I got to get headphones, okay, all right, well, okay, get, just turn it, like, let me, okay, let you don't hear anything? You hear a buzz. All right, let me, all right, yeah, you're right. I can't hear anything. All right, I gotta move this over here, and then I gotta do that. All right, you can hear yourself, right? All right, you can hear yourself. You can't hear anything else. All right. Jerry rig, jerry rig, jerry rig. Oh, you don't even have a seat. Let me get you a seat. Okay. All right. Are you good? Are you happy, Fatty? You're sitting down. You're broadcasting. Like, this is all, like, about 30 minutes later, right? And this is when Michael Pepe just shows up. You know what I mean? And, like, he doesn't... It's not like Sarah's in her seat. Pepe can't sit in her chair yet or whatever. But here's the thing. That's kind of the old way. The new way is that Michael Pepe shows up and Sarah's already clocked out. Or she's already, like, in a... If she shows up, it's like a post-credit scene in a movie. Like, she's already rolled the credits. But then it's like she comes back down and is like, hey, I still got 5 minutes of Wolverine exposition. Or like, oh, who knows, maybe a little Thanos is going to come by or whatever, right? The Avengers need to be reborn, right? So there's always like a little tease maybe at the end. But if she comes down, she's not like really, like, Pepe sitting in her seat, but then she just wants to come down and like hang out and go like, all right, well, Charlie's okay for now. Who's the character that, like, there's like a wall and there's a hole in it, and then somebody has to stick their finger in the wall to keep the water from flowing, you know? It's kind of like Sarah is the kid with the finger, and Charlie is the leaking wall. Hang on, I just got a phone call. Okay, yeah. So, I should just shut the fuck up. Now you get it. It's about you shutting the fuck up. No, but it's a thing. It's too many people. The thing is that the room is built for four. And if Sarah, like, kind of disappears and Michael Pepe shows up, great. You know, of course. Pepe gets a chair. There's headphones. He's got a microphone. He's got a little data pad there to do a little chatting on the Twitch, you know, blah, 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 blah. Everyone's taken care of. But the thing is that it's like Doug is going to leave, right? So there's an open chair. So it's just like, oh, yeah, well, you know, Pepe could sit there. But the thing is, Pepe's always like, he's like the Chris Elliott or something. He's like the regular, like, guest spot, you know, kind of guy. And here's, like, a guest situation. Hal's art friends, who are unprecedented guests. Like, people that have never been there before. And I figure, like, make the good first impression with the people that have never been there before. You know, kind of a thing. It's kind of like when I go to Delfina. I go there and it's like, hey, Rob, everyone knows me, right? But the thing is, like, they're so busy saying hi and being cordial and everything. It's just like, no, I'm here to eat and stuff and get some coffee. But they're just like, oh, yeah, he's just a guy that just shows up. And they're like, meanwhile, like, 10 other people have been taking their seats and everything. And it's just like, oh, I could have been eating already, you know, had I not just been waving and smiling or whatever, right? Kind of a thing. Anyway, that's what happened tonight. But But I figure, like, well, Pepe always takes these random weeks off. Like, sometimes he takes 3 weeks off. Sometimes he takes 4 weeks off. I don't think he's ever just been every other week. I think it's been, like, every 3 weeks or something like that. So I think what's happening now is that, like, this upcoming week will have been, I think, the third week. So it's kind of like, maybe he feels that it's time because it's a 3 week thing. But I still have a feeling that even Michael Pepe doesn't want to subscribe to a every blank week commitment, like a every 3 week or an every 4 week or an every 2 week. He's definitely not an every week, but I don't think he wants to be an every other week. And I think that he's kind of cooler with an every 3 week, but I don't even think he likes to prescribe to, like, that systematic box-checking attendance thing. I think he just likes to be the wild card. He just shows up when he shows up, and it's just like every time he's there, it's like, hey, here he is, cool, you know. And then we get to make fun of the fact that he's, when he's not there, we're smoking all of his fatties. His deserved fatties. Yeah. The deserved fatties. So, you know, it's like, so Relodio is blatant injustice. That's all I'm saying. And it doesn't even have to be an inside job, because it's just, it's got injustice woven into its DNA. So there's no difference between good or evil. It's just, it is what it is, and it's, and historically, literally, it's on the bad side of history. So, with that, I think Saturday is going to be a day of fun and frivolity or whatever. It's too bad that Doug won't be around to smoke birthday fatties. But I figured Hal will make the fatties nice, because he is being he is being like a host himself by his invitation of his art buddies. And I said, like, hey, you know, there's art guys you hang out with and stuff. If they ever wanted to come to Relodio, you know, fine, you know, let them do it. But it's just like, even with Doug out of the chair, and with Sarah potentially out of the chair, it's still kind of nuts. You know what I mean? Like, if there were two people, no Doug, and Sarah's missing for the last half, like, that would still be a crowded room. That would still be five. That would still be a jerry-rigged fifth, and not a comfortable four. You know what I mean? So, and I want to invite my mom into the thing. So it's just like, I would rather not be. So I would not be stressing about the potential fuckery of the impending night while I'm being all cupcakey and going, hey, Mom, check out this thing I made. All right, that's the story. So over the edge in about 45-something minutes, 48 minutes. And I guess, yeah. See, this is narrow casting. Everything I've been saying has been for VJ Pussycat's benefit. And the thing is, you won't be able to go back and go like, oh, I'll just replay it from the stream, because it'll be overridden by Over the Edge files in the future. But again, it's not terribly important. But I just figured, like, it's this whole thing about, like, like, oh, we do the show once every this, once every that. Oh, and then if there's the fifth Thursday, there's this. But it's like, it's not a fifth Thursday, it's fifth Friday. And then it's a 5-hour show. It's like, who does it? Doug does it. He goes, but sometimes Doug doesn't want to do it. And it's like this and that. He goes, like, well, Wobbly is on tour, and Wobbly flipped the idea. And it's like, he flipped it. He goes, like, why did he flip it? Well, because there was a show that was supposed to be played, but it wasn't played because KVFA didn't play the file. So it's like, Wobbly felt charitable. And he said, like, well, why don't you just take my slot and have him rerun it? And they ended up did rerunning, but it flipped the whole even odd. I still call it Thursday night, but it's technically Friday morning. And that's how they're going to appropriate the whole Thursday night, Friday morning thing. And that's just one show. Right? There's just one show, right? And it's, and then there's other things that, you know, fit into a 3-hour format that I do, and Doug does a thing, and Hal does a thing, and then we all do a thing, and then you know, you need a fucking manual. A Japanese fucking technical manual. No English, actually, yeah. You just in character fonts. Or in Aurevesh. There you go. Write it in Aurevesh. And then do like a you know, job is through with you, kind of a thing. Just that as an aside. Kind of knowing that you're about to be shot by a laser weapon. But yeah, no, it's BJ and then me, and if Pete was around, Pete would be doing it, you know? We would have that crossover moment, you know? Where it's just like, I'm king of the world, oh no, I suck. Who's king of the world? Oh, you're king, oh, okay. And those are always peaceful transferences of power, you know? Historically, literally. Too many people, yeah. But yeah, all you have to remember is the fifth is a jerry rig. When you're pleading the fifth, when you get a fifth person in there, a fifth body, it's a jerry rig situation. Like if Jericho is hanging around. And Jericho is a guy who is anti-jerry-rigged, jerry-riggable. Because he won't speak into the mic, he won't wear earphones, he'll just be barking out problems like, how come I'm not hearing Whitesnake? God damn it! It's like, yeah, wear earphones. And even if you were wearing earphones, you'd probably be missing it anyway. But yeah, no, I think having the sub-integrated loose cannon jerry-rig/un-jerry-riggable fifth is kind of fun, like a Jericho or like Tracy maybe. She was there a couple times, but she was just sitting on the couch. She didn't want to like be on mic, I don't think. When Don and Tracy were there like a little bit ago. So, what are you doing? Yeah, I'm streaming all of Gizzard's Festival. Gizzard Fest is over at 9, so I'd like to stream straight into Relodio. Alright, well, let's think about that. And if I'm not there exactly at 9, then hopefully Sarah will just have, like, a, you know, like a KTEL Greatest Hits kind of Spotify thing going. Something akin to Nextdoor's sound, only it would be like a more some data junk. Yeah. Or, you know, she could just get on mic and talk about her vacation. You know. I could use one of those. Actually, I'm good. I don't. I just need cleaner sheets in my bed. So let's test the line here.
Today, when a product doesn't.
Oh, okay. What do you got going in here? What do you got? What is this? I'm gonna radio station. What are you gonna do? What is this? What are you doing in here? What is this? I find that when the lights are off, people are way more interested in what's going on. When the lights are on, they're like, "Ooh, I don't know. That's kind of weird." But whether okay, so the lights are off. They may or may not be hearing anything. But what they're responding to is an open door. Through the filter of inebriation, right? So they're going like, hey, what's going on? What is this? What are you... Yeah. So, and the lights are on now. So that's why you get quick glances. You don't get verbal inquisition. Slurred verbal inquisition. And then a hairdresser comes by and knows exactly what's happening. It's a funk party for about three people. There's more people on the sidewalk wondering what they're going to do with the rest of their night than there are people in the bar having their night. Because when you're in the bar, it's like, oh, no, we're here. We've arrived. And it's... And people are questioning their arrival. They're thinking, like, I think we need to be in the on the departure side of the airport. Waiting for their, you know, bags to roll in front of them. Only your hairdresser knows for sure.
Every season, every age has its own special beauty. But the quality of freshness never loses its appeal. Her hair is soft and shiny. The color fresh, sparkling. Does she or doesn't she?
Oh, that's does she or doesn't she. There it is.
Miss Clairol hair color looks so natural, only your hairdresser knows for sure.
Indeed. There's too many papal. People, huh, is like popol vuh, popol vuh. How do you do that one? How do you pronounce that?
Popol Vuh. Popol Vuh.
Too many Popol Vuh.
Popol Vuh.
Only your Popol Vuh knows for sure. This scene from Batman was banned until now.
I went to Europe to do my spaghetti western, and before I left, I'd done a series of commercials for Nestle's Quick.
Okay.
I played a spoof on James Bond, Captain Quick.
In 1967, Adam West put on his Batman costume one last time for a secret project. He filmed something in London that disappeared for over 50 years. No American fan had ever seen it. Not even the biggest Batman collectors knew it existed. The footage was locked away in British archives, forgotten by everyone. Then, in 2018, someone found it during a search for lost TV history. What Adam West said in that missing scene shocked viewers. The discovery proved that even the most famous superheroes can hide dark secrets. In 1964, Ed Graham Productions picked up the rights to develop a Batman TV series. The idea was to make a straightforward Saturday morning adventure, something in the style of the adventures of Superman that CBS had aired for children back in the 1950s. The plan was to cast Mike Henry, an NFL linebacker who later became Tarzan, as the first live-action Batman on television. By 1965, CBS was close to signing the deal, but weeks of talks stalled. The network never picked up the show. If it had gone through, Batman might have ended up as a tame children's program, which could have crushed the character's place in pop culture for years to come. Henry soon left the project to play Tarzan, and the whole plan collapsed just before filming was set to begin. That failure meant the world never saw a Saturday morning Batman, but it also cleared the way for the primetime version that later took the world by storm. That same year, something unexpected happened at Hugh Hefner's Playboy Mansion in Chicago. Hefner decided to screen all 15 episodes of the old 1943 Batman serial. The gathering was filled with celebrities and socialites. At first, it looked like nothing more than a nostalgic party, but it set off a cultural reaction that no one had predicted. Guests dressed up, shouted at the screen, booed the villain, and cheered during the action. The New York Times and other outlets covered the screenings, noting the wild atmosphere. Suddenly, Hollywood executives began to see Batman in a new light. The old serial, once forgotten, had become trendy again. Hefner's party showed that people were willing to embrace Batman's over-the-top style as entertainment. Without that event, the character might have stayed locked away in dusty film reels. In 1965, Columbia Pictures took advantage of the buzz and recut the 1943 serial into a single 4.5-hour film called An Evening with Batman and Robin. It premiered at the Playboy Theater in Chicago and quickly spread to art house cinemas and college towns. Crowds poured in, with theaters selling out midnight showings and concessions hitting record sales. Some theaters even split the screenings over 2 days, with 7 chapters on Saturday and 8 on Sunday. Reports described lines stretching around the block, with fans showing up in costume. The success stunned Columbia executives and also caught the attention of ABC. The numbers told the story clearly. Batman could draw huge audiences. Those ticket sales and headlines convinced the network that a live-action Batman show could be a major hit. Around this time, Yale Udoff, a young executive at ABC, stepped into the spotlight. Udoff had been a Batman fan since he was a child. And after seeing the audience reaction in Chicago, he believed more than ever that the character belonged on television. He began pushing the idea at every meeting, even shouting, "We ought to do Batman," at his bosses. At first, they laughed him off, but Udoff refused to stop. He wrote a full proposal for a stylish series that mixed elements from James Bond and The Man from UNCLE. His persistence became legendary. Some ABC executives even admitted they started reading Batman comics in secret, hiding them inside business magazines on cross-country flights. In the end, Udoff's determination played a key role in convincing ABC to take the gamble. When William Dozier was hired as the producer in 1966, he admitted something surprising. He had never read a comic book before. When he finally picked up a few Batman issues for research, he found them so strange that he decided the material couldn't be taken seriously at all. Gadgets like shark-repellent bat spray and storylines about Batman surfing against the Joker convinced him that the only way forward was comedy.
Live up to its promise. Today, when a product doesn't live up to its promise, who cares?
Than copying the comics directly, he chose to make the show a campy parody. It was a bold choice at a time when American culture was already filled with satire, from Andy Warhol's art to Lichtenstein's comic-inspired paintings. The result was unlike anything on television. Bright costumes, exaggerated villains, and words like pow and bam flashing across the screen defined the style. Dozier's approach worked. When Batman premiered in January 1966, it became an instant sensation. Not everyone supported Dozier's vision. The famous espionage novelist Eric Ambler had originally been hired to write a feature-length Batman movie to launch the series. But as soon as he learned that Dozier planned to turn the character into a pop art comedy, he walked away from the project. Known for serious thrillers, Ambler wanted nothing to do with satire. His sudden exit showed just how unusual Dozier's idea was. Hollywood rarely saw a writer abandon such a big assignment simply because he disagreed with the direction. Casting was another turning point. In 1965, two full-screen tests were filmed. One featured Adam West and Burt Ward. The other starred Lyle Waggoner as Batman and Peter Dayelle as Robin. Waggoner was the safer choice. He was already known in Hollywood and had the look executives expected. West, however, was almost unknown. When the test footage was compared side by side, it was West and Ward who captured the quirky, campy energy Dozier wanted. The studio decided to take the risk, turning down the more established star. Waggoner went on to succeed in other shows, including The Carol Burnett Show and Wonder Woman. But it was West and Ward who brought Batman and Robin to life in a way no one else could. Adam West's path to the role was especially unlikely. He had caught the producer's attention through a Nestle Quick commercial. His deadpan delivery in that ad showed he could deliver outrageous lines with a straight face. Dozier immediately recognized that this was exactly the tone the show needed. West signed his contract on September 21, 1965, beating out bigger names simply because he could make Batman seem both serious and funny at the same time. That unique mix made his performance unforgettable. Burt Ward, meanwhile, was cast as Robin in 1966. At the time, he was 20 years old, although the character was written as a teenager in high school. Ward's youthful appearance convinced audiences he was closer to 15 or 16. Behind the scenes, he performed his own stunts, which landed him in the hospital four times in his first 5 days of filming. The injuries showed how much he threw himself into the role. Fans debated his real age for years, but his energy and athleticism sold the character perfectly. Supporting the two leads were experienced stage actors who added weight to the show. Alan Napier, born in 1903 and related to former British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, played Alfred. Trained at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London, Napier had been performing since the 1920s and was 63 when he joined Batman in 1966. Neil Hamilton, who played Commissioner Gordon, brought with him a long history from silent films and stage plays. Their backgrounds helped ground the show, giving a sense of seriousness that balanced the colorful chaos around them. In 1954, a psychiatrist named Frederick Wertham published a book called Seduction of the Innocent. In it, he made a claim that shocked readers and quickly spread across America. Wertham said that Batman stories were psychologically homosexual. He pointed to the fact that Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson lived together, had no women in their home, and were sometimes shown relaxing side by side. He even cited cases of boys telling him they wished they could live with Bruce Wayne. Wertham went so far as to call the comic a wish dream of two homosexuals living together. His ideas connected with the wider fears of the 1950s, during the height of what was known as the Lavender Scare. The accusation didn't disappear after the book. It lingered for years and cast a long shadow over Batman. By the 1960s, when the Batman TV series became a cultural phenomenon, producers and actors still worried that any detail in the show might bring the controversy back. Even dialogue, costumes, or storylines were...
Hey, VJ, are you there? Are you Sans phone? All right, well, I'll wait for a ping on the chat.
Carefully watched, making Batman one of the most closely analyzed children's shows of its time for hidden social meaning. The tension broke into the open in 1967 when a magazine called TV Radio Album ran an article titled The Whisper Campaign Against Batman and Robin. It was only 2 pages long, with the rest of the spread filled with photos of the costumed heroes, but its words carried weight. For the first time, a mainstream publication discussed the rumors about Batman and Robin's relationship and about the actors Adam West and Burt Ward. Though the article denied the claims, it also made sly comparisons. One line read, "Though both of them must have heard the whispers, like Liberace some years ago, they are doubtless laughing all the way to the bank." The remark was a nod to the famous pianist Liberace, who in the 1950s had sued newspapers for implying he was gay and had once joked that he cried all the way to the bank. After winning damages of $8,000, about $22,000 at the time. By referencing him, the magazine fed the rumors while pretending to dismiss them. It showed how deeply the whispers had grown, turning into a public flashpoint for debates about sexuality and television in that era. The comparisons to Liberace were not casual. They revealed how coded language and sly allusions allowed writers to raise the subject without making direct accusations. The TV Radio Album article leaned into this technique, knowing readers would connect the dots. The piece suggested that, like Liberace, the Batman stars were in on the joke, enjoying their fame while ignoring the gossip. But for the producers of the show, the rumors were no joke. They feared that the idea of a homosexual atmosphere around the series could drive away sponsors and the family audience. ABC executives quickly stepped in. Their solution was to rewrite parts of the show to make Batman's attraction to women more obvious. One striking example came in a scene where Batman tells Robin that his interest in pretty supervillainesses was due to the first oncoming thrusts of manhood. The line was heavy-handed, but it was deliberate. From then on, the scripts often included Batman showing interest in women, even if it felt unnatural for the campy style of the series. It was a calculated move to reassure the audience and sponsors that the Caped Crusader was safely heterosexual. The campaign didn't stop with the script.
It didn't
Behind
stop.
The scenes, the studio launched a publicity drive to present Adam West and Burt Ward as undeniably masculine. Magazines and press kits showcased them practicing karate, talking about their marriages, or showing off their children. Even their workouts and hobbies were framed as proof of manliness. The effort was almost desperate, but it reflected how much pressure was on the actors and the network. A simple rumor in the 1960s could threaten not just a star's reputation, but the success of an entire series. Meanwhile, the show itself began to face problems that had nothing to do with rumors. In January 1966, Batman exploded onto television screens and was an instant sensation. At its peak, in February, it was watched in 14 million homes, grabbing an astonishing 42% of the viewing audience. But the excitement didn't last. By March 1966, the Wednesday night episodes had dropped so much that they barely stayed in the weekly top 20. ABC memos at the time admitted that the novelty was wearing off and that the formula was already starting to feel repetitive. The phrase "Batman fatigue" began making the rounds. By the summer of 1966, the decline had turned into a collapse. Just months earlier, Batman had been one of the most popular shows in the country. But an Associated Press article on August 11th reported that ratings had taken a sharp decline, and Batman no longer appeared on the list of top-rated programs. Merchandise was still selling well, but the viewers were gone. Networks had expected some drop in the summer months, but this was far steeper than usual. The craze that had influenced fashion and slang was already fading into the past. The Batman movie, released in 1966, was supposed to revive the excitement. The studio poured money into promotion and expected a major hit. Instead, the film earned only $1.7 million at the box office. It performed at 122% of a normal film in 20 key cities. But studio experts had expected closer to 200% for a true hit. Merchandise sales stayed strong, but the movie itself failed to make a profit. The letdown shocked both 20th Century Fox and ABC, who had counted on the film to extend the life of the franchise. When the second season began in September 1966, the ratings told a grim story. Batman averaged in 34th place across all shows on television, a devastating drop from its top five position earlier that year. Some episodes even slid into the 40s in the rankings. Adding new villains like the Archer and Catwoman didn't help. The numbers made it clear that the magic had faded, and cast members openly worried that cancellation was coming. The most surprising piece of so-called banned Batman content from the 1966 era wasn't an American TV episode at all. It came from London in May 1967, when Adam West stepped into his Batman costume to film a road safety message for British children. For more than 50 years, no one had seen this footage. Not even the most devoted American Batman fans knew it existed. The film was finally brought back to light in 2018, when the archive group Kaleidoscope discovered it during a campaign to recover the United Kingdom's top 100 missing television clips. Until then, it had never been screened outside Britain, and most assumed it was lost forever. When the public finally saw it in 2018, it felt like uncovering a hidden treasure from both superhero and British cultural history. In the clip, Batman uses his fame to teach children the curb drill, Britain's version of road safety rules. Standing on a quiet street, Adam West warns children about the deadly daily danger they face when crossing the road. He demonstrates the steps with calm authority. Stop at the curb, look right, look left, look right again, and only cross when it's safe. He stays fully in character as Batman, blending the American superhero image with British safety advice in a way no other actor has ever done. For decades, the film remained unknown, making its 2018 rediscovery a powerful reminder that even the biggest franchises can lose pieces of their history. The first public showing took place on April 14, 2018, at Birmingham City University. The screening marked the beginning of Kaleidoscope's nationwide search for 100 lost television gems, including episodes of Doctor Who and The Avengers. The event drew both professionals and longtime fans, many of whom were stunned to learn Batman had once starred in a forgotten road safety film. The rediscovery proved how much important media still lies hidden in archives and private collections, waiting to be found. Another piece of Batman history that puzzled fans involved the singer Leslie Gore. She appeared as Catwoman's sidekick Pussycat in the two-part episode Scat Darn Catwoman, which aired on January 25, 1967. During the story, she performed two songs, California Nights and Maybe Now. While California Nights remained, Maybe Now vanished from American reruns for reasons no one has ever explained. The song had been written with her brother, Michael Gore, and released as the B-side of her single, Treat Me Like a Lady. Although some prints and foreign broadcasts still included it, American cable reruns and ME-TV airings cut the performance. Many viewers never knew it existed, turning the missing number into one of the show's oddest mysteries. There was also a controversial moment involving Commissioner Gordon. In one version of the show, Batman takes him into the Batcave, where Alfred uses bat sleep spray to knock him unconscious so he will forget seeing the hero's secret identities. Some syndications trimmed this scene or removed the gassing entirely, as producers worried about showing a police commissioner being drugged, even in a campy context. Other versions downplayed Gordon's presence in the Batcave altogether. The edits showed how even lighthearted television had to watch its boundaries, especially with millions of children watching. Not all the unusual stories from the Batman era came from the screen. In the late 1960s, Adam West was banned from Aspen, Colorado, for 15 years after a notorious party spiraled out of control. He later admitted, liquor? Yes. Women? Yes. Police? Yes. Rumors at the time described him as a Hollywood hellraiser. Some claimed the ban stemmed from noise complaints and property damage, though no criminal charges were ever filed. Exactly 15 years later, West received a letter from Aspen officials confirming he could return. The episode cemented his reputation as more than just a television superhero. Off camera, West and Burt Ward became just as famous for their nightlife as they were for fighting Gotham's villains. Ward later admitted that they often encountered eager fans while still wearing their costumes. In his autobiography, he described encounters that shocked readers and embarrassed the show's producers. He even claimed he once escaped a jealous husband by leaping from a motel window into the mud. These tales added to the rumors swirling around the stars, while West himself argued that Ward exaggerated many of them. Still, the gossip strained their working relationship and worried network executives who feared the show's family-friendly image could be damaged. Even their co-stars added to the show's legend. Cesar Romero, who played the Joker, famously refused to shave his mustache. Instead, the makeup team covered it with thick white paint for all 120 episodes and the 1966 film. The faint outline is still visible in close-ups, making Romero's Joker unforgettable. What started as a personal vanity became one of the most talked-about quirks in the entire Batman franchise. Behind the scenes, the cast often lived as wildly as their on-screen characters. According to both West and Ward, their success led to endless parties filled with late nights, alcohol, and constant attention. These gatherings sometimes lasted until dawn, leaving actors tired during filming and forcing makeup crews to work extra hard to keep them looking fresh. Accounts from the time confirm that the off-camera chaos occasionally rivaled the outlandish adventures that aired each week. The Batman of the 1960s remains remembered, not just for its colorful action and campy humor, but also for the countless hidden stories that surrounded it. In 1966, the legendary science fiction writer Harlan Ellison was asked to pitch an episode for the Batman TV show. He chose to bring in the tragic villain Two-Face, a character who had never been seen on the series, even though he was one of Batman's most famous enemies. Ellison called his story The Two-Way Crimes of Two-Face. It fit the show's playful, campy style, but also carried a darker edge that made it stand out. At one point, actor Clint Eastwood was even discussed for the role, which would have added enormous star power to the series. But Ellison's pitch arrived on the same day. A key executive at ABC was leaving the network. Because of that timing and the politics behind the scenes, the script was rejected. The idea stayed buried in Ellison's files for nearly 50 years. It wasn't until 2014 that DC finally adapted it into a comic called Batman 66, The Lost Episode, giving fans a glimpse of what could have been. The show also invested heavily in creating the Batboat for both the TV series and its 1966 movie. The custom boat was built by Glastron and loaded with gadgets meant to dazzle viewers. It made its first appearance in the film, but the cost of filming on water was shocking. Each scene required special equipment, more crew, and extra safety measures, often adding thousands of dollars per shoot. Because of the cost, producers used the Batboat only sparingly, and soon it was locked away in storage. For fans, it became almost mythical, a reminder of how tight budgets forced the show to cut back on some of its most exciting ideas. By the third season in 1968, Batman's ratings had collapsed. ABC canceled the show abruptly, but just as hope seemed gone, NBC showed interest in saving it with a fourth season. Then a stunning mistake was revealed. The producers had already bulldozed the sets, including the Batcave, Wayne Manor, and Commissioner Gordon's office. The cost to rebuild them was estimated at several hundred thousand dollars, equal to more than $2 million today. When NBC learned of this, they dropped the idea. What could have been a rescue for the series ended in what is now remembered as one of television's most expensive production blunders. For years, fans believed NBC had seriously planned a fourth season, but official records tell a different story. Ratings had already hit their lowest point, and the budget was running at a loss. Only 17 episodes were ordered for the third season, and costly features like the Batboat were either dropped or rarely used. Once the sets were destroyed, the expense of rebuilding them was too high for 1968 television. Beyond a brief inquiry, NBC never moved forward. The idea of a lost fourth season remains more of a legend than reality, with documents showing it was financially impossible from the start. While Batman was still popular, producers had explored spin-offs. One was a Batgirl series.
Yes.
A pilot was even filmed, though she ended up being added to the main show instead. Other ideas included a show for Robin, and even one that would highlight other DC heroes, a kind of early Justice League. Some of these projects made it to the pitch stage with concept art and network discussions. But when Batman collapsed in its third season and the sets were destroyed, every spin-off was canceled. Some were dropped just days before casting was set to begin. Network memos from 1967 and 1968 confirm that the end of Batman also meant the end of any chance to build a larger superhero universe.
So the show has been confirmed to be loaded and played on KPFA. It'll happen, I'm guessing, at 30 seconds past the hour of the digital clock here at RV. Digital clock now is 23:53 and 3 seconds. So in 7 minutes and 20 seconds, I'm going to play Over the Edge. VJ, are you still on the phone? Are you still on the phone? It's a Mark Snick.
Yeah. having some coffee. Thank you. Hello, everybody. This is Albert Brooks, and I'm real happy to be here. Don't ask me how it happened, why I'm in this town. It's a long story, but anyway, they said, would you come down to the station, take some calls? I said, you got it. So call in, we'll chat, and have some fun. What do I do? Line one it is. Let's go. Hello, this is Albert Brooks.
The woman that called in earlier college.
No, no, wait.
I'm so sick of that. Save the trees. What are you going to build your house out of? Meat?
No, no, sir. This is Albert Brooks. I don't know what call you're referring to.
What the hell is going on?
Okay, fine. Let's go to line two.
You can hear him talking.
Hello, this is Albert Brooks.
Hey, come over here.
No. Oh, ma'am, put down the phone. No, come back, please. Come on the air.
Al.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. You're too much. We're big fans of yours.
Oh, thank you very much. What's on your mind?
Listen, I got a joke for you.
Ah, shoot.
All right.
Thank
it's one of these good news, bad news jokes.
Oh, okay.
All right, now you play a part in it, too.
Right.
I'm going to say to you, Al, I got some good news and bad news.
Right, and I'll say...
My name's Tom.
Yeah.
You say, Tom, give me the bad news.
All right.
And then I'll give you the bad news, and then you say, give me the good news.
Fine. Okay,
all
Tom,
right?
Give me the bad news.
What?
What's the bad news?
Oh, I didn't know we were starting.
Yeah.
I've got to start.
All right.
Now,
yeah.
I got some good news and bad news for you.
Okay, Tom.
Yeah?
Give me the bad
all
news.
All right, Al. The bad news is I haven't got any good news for you.
Uh-oh. What's the good news, Tom?
Well, the good news, Al, that's all the bad news I got.
Oh, great.
A little different, isn't it?
Certainly
that's
is.
A switch.
It is a switch. Let's both laugh at it.
Sure.
All right? Thanks, Tom.
All right.
All right, let's go on line three. Hello. Oh, my, listen. That's interesting. Hello.
I play 11 other instruments.
Very good.
Goodbye.
All right.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Let's go to line three. Hello.
Oh, yeah, Albert Brooks.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, nice to talk to you. Listen, I'm a disc jockey here in town.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, I'm in the kind of a comedy bag.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a few questions. Pick your brain.
All right, be careful.
Oh, for sure. All right, how important is the element of surprise in comedy?
That's about the stupidest question I've ever heard. What kind of a moron are you?
Hey, watch it, will you?
No, you see, I was just surprising you.
Surprising me. I get it. I see what you did. You turned it around.
That's right.
All right. What about delivery?
Well, I think you can pick it up yourself, can't you?
All right, I guess I could, but what if you're a two-man team? Each guy pick up half of it?
Mm-hmm.
Pick up half of it.
Writing?
I'm writing.
All right.
All right, finally, one last question.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, how important is writing your own material?
Well, I think it's very important.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you think funny?
I'll tell you,
mm-hmm.
I don't think funny, but I am funny.
Are you really funny?
Really funny.
Well, I'd say you're all right then. Just do the best you can.
Best you can.
Mm-hmm.
Out of sight.
Thank you.
Hey, drive carefully, huh?
I will. All right, let's move on. I think...
You don't believe that.
You're damn right I don't believe that. Help me, man, I'm sick.
All right, how long are you in town for, Albert?
I don't know, maybe forever. I feel catatonic.
All right, stay there. I'm Dr. Mark Heller. I'll call you right after the show.
It is after the show.
Oh.
Hold on.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've had a B.A.